From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update of news and events from Latin America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua. So let's just dive right in. We have quite a full plate as usual.
Yeah, the big news over the weekend was the result of the Colombian election, which went very much according to predictions. And the guy who came out first in the first round of the voting was Iván Duque, who's an extreme right-wing politician, very close to former
Uribe, right?
President Álvaro Uribe, narco-terror president extraordinaire.
Right.
Iván Duque got something like, I've forgotten what it was, 33-34% of the vote. And then after him, Gustavo Petro, the former mayor of Bogotá, Colombia's capital, he came second with something like 26, almost 27% of the vote. And then behind him, there was another guy called Sergio Fajardo, who was also a relatively progressive candidate, and he had 25% of the vote. So although I know one can't project those kinds of results, you know, directly, you can't just simply add things up and say, well, that'll be the vote in the second round.
Right.
It does look as though Petro will have the advantage, which is extraordinary, going into the second round, because apart from the vote by Fajardo, there were other votes for kind of centrist and even left-wing parties, and that means that the Petro going into the second round, in theory, could have over 50% of the vote. Which is extraordinary.
That's remarkable. Yeah, that is kind of remarkable.
So that doesn't mean that Gustavo Petro is kind of a kind of radical progressive by any means. I mean, he's more he's more like somebody like Luis Solís, the former Costa Rican president, or the current president there, Alvarado. And they're kind of centrist social democrat types. And it doesn't necessarily mean, let's assume that Petro wins, just for argument's sake. And if he wins, it's unlikely to make much difference to the situation in between Venezuela and Colombia, because Petro has made very clear that he even refers to Nicolas Maduro as a dictator.
Yeah.
That might just be for electoral purposes, but even if it's not, Petro, when he gets into office, he'll face a National Assembly that's pretty much controlled by the right wing. So he'll have difficulty getting any legislative program through the Colombian legislature. And also he'll be up against the inertia of Colombia's civil servants, both domestically and in their diplomatic service. So it's very unlikely that Colombia's policy towards Venezuela will change. They'll probably remain a member of the Group of Lima, for example, and they'll probably remain extremely susceptible to pressure from the United States government. And let's see, we don't know. But that's if Petro wins. That's the good case. Now, the worst case is if Iván Duque wins. And that means that if Iván Duque wins, there's every chance of some kind of military escalation along the Colombian-Venezuelan border, which probably wouldn't happen under Petro.
Right.
But let's, you know, and so that's looked at in regional terms, that's the situation vis-a-vis Venezuela. And in domestic terms, Iván Duque is, although he says he's not, he is hostile to the peace process and would probably destroy it even more than it is destroyed already. Whereas Petro would probably try and do what he could to rescue it and go some way to meeting the commitments of the Colombian government in that peace agreement that Juan Manuel Santos has studiedly, in a very studied way, avoided implementing, claiming the other powers of state in Colombia are the ones that are holding things up. But if he wanted to push the peace process through and the various provisions that he hasn't honored, his government hasn't honored, he could.
Right.
So then...
Let me ask you something about this. Because, I mean, this, you know, we've been watching Colombia for years now, you know, here, you know, doing this segment. And of course, the last couple of years with the peace process, we've had, the outgoing president, who is a right winger, a soft right winger when compared to Uribe, right. Because he at least wanted to follow this track, compared to Uribe, sort of tempered somewhat the death squad activities, etc. In other words, they tried to broker a peace with, and successfully did, to a degree, a peace with FARC and the other left opposition groups. You come to the election where you have FARC represented also in the election, and you have a hard right candidate and a, I guess you call them a centrist, I guess, Petro, with whom I'm in Colombia. I'm wondering if after 60 years of civil war, that we've seen maybe a trend that was first with the current president and now the shaping out of the candidates here, that the people are looking to find like some kind of center so that the polarity that's been represented in the civil war, or the perception of that, is being put to rest. I mean, people have this concept of extreme poles, fighting all the time, and that if you can find a centrist, that this balances. I mean, it's generally an illusion because the terms themselves are pretty elastic if they have any meaning at all. But I'm wondering if the idea that Petro was looked at as a sane, middle of the roader. Is what got him lift.
I think there's a lot of truth to that, and I think that people were misled by last year's referendum, in which there was a no vote against the peace agreement. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do.
A very narrow vote. Now, that happened at a very difficult time. There was a relatively low turnout of I think it was just over 40%, the turnout. But that was also due to extraordinary extreme weather conditions at the time, which prevented large numbers of people from even voting.
Right.
Especially in the parts of Colombia where the rainfalls were heaviest.
Yeah, because they're saying yesterday was 53.37% turnout.
That's right, which is very high for Colombia, actually, or relatively high.
Well, it's higher than 40% for sure.
Yeah. So, and I think that people, observers, may have had a false idea of the strength of the right wing based on what happened last year in that referendum. Because, for example, the Germán Vargas Lleras, who was the vice president, Santos's vice president, he resigned from being vice president to be able to run in the election. He was slated to get over 20%, and he only got 7%. And so that gives you an indication of how misleading the referendum result was, and it does indicate that, as you say, there's a strong underswell, if you like, of feeling for a more centrist, more moderate government, especially because now you see one of the reasons that Uribe was able to take power in the first place and win re-election was because of the war. But now the war's over.
Right.
And at least as far as the FARC's concerned. And there's still a smaller guerrilla group called the ELN that are currently in peace negotiations with the government of Juan Manuel Santos. But the main war is over. And so people now feel, oh, right, well, we're safe now. We can vote for the center. Because we don't need to vote for the right wing to protect us from the guerrilla.
Right.
And that, however false that psychology may have been, however untrue it may have been, that was a strong element in the appeal of Alvaro Uribe that made it possible for him to have two terms as president. So then, yeah, but let's see what happens. The office is June the 17th. There's that's a month away, almost. What, 3 weeks? Something like that.
Yeah.
And so we'll see what happens between now and then. And an interesting comment that I read in an analysis of the result by a team of Colombian analysts is that Duque can't run on fear, which is what Alvaro Uribe used to win his campaigns on, as I was saying earlier.
Right.
But these analysts say that now the ground is open for people like Petro to campaign on positive things like improving the economy, expanding middle class, stuff like that. But one of the interesting things that neither Duque nor Petro mentioned was poverty reduction, and I think that says a lot about the way the electoral context in this kind of South American and Central American Caribbean country that has been dominated by right-wing governments for decades, the context doesn't allow politicians to talk even in moderate reformist terms of poverty reduction. They have to talk in terms of strengthening the middle class, right?
Yeah.
No, which may be code for the same thing, but
right.
You know, so there. I know we'll see what happens in Colombia. In Venezuela, following the very important election victory by Nicolas Maduro, there he won. Although the turnout was relatively low by Venezuelan standards, 46%. He won with a 67% margin over his nearest rival. And of course, one has to remember that was with an opposition boycott by two or three quite important opposition parties. But he'd have won anyway. And if you look at the numbers. So in the wake of that election victory, Nicolas Maduro is calling for national dialogue. He is trying to reach out to opposition sectors and cut the ground out from under the most extremist sections of the political opposition in Venezuela. And another thing that he's done is there's a guy called Bob Corker, who apparently is a Republican senator in the United States.
Yes.
With a lot of influence. Is he the chair of the Foreign Relations Committee in the Senate?
He's on it, right.
So he visited Venezuela either shortly before or shortly after the election, and that led to the liberation of a U.S. citizen called Joshua Holt, who had been detained and imprisoned in 2016,
yeah,
basically on charges of terrorism.
Yeah, he does chair the Foreign Relations Committee, yeah, sorry.
Right, okay. So, yeah, so now analysts in Venezuela are looking at that and saying, well, that's one in the eye for Donald Trump and for Marco Rubio, because what Bob Corker has done is take advantage of his position in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee to open up an alternate channel of communication with the Venezuelan government that flies right in the face of the foreign policy of Donald Trump and, of course, of the schemes of people like Marco Rubio, Bob Menendez, and the former congressperson, Ileana Rose-Litton, and she's not right in Congress anymore, is she? But that's quite important in terms of what is the configuration of the relationship between the Venezuelan government and the U.S. government.
That's an interesting thing, too, by the way, because the foreign policy that Trump has been following towards Venezuela, in fact, at least formally, hasn't changed. Obama was following the same track. He issued executive orders that found that Venezuela was constituted a threat to it was a fundamental threat to the United States, basically, an absurd finding, but a declaration and actions that flowed from that. Obama renewed his own executive order on that point, and then when Trump came in, he also renewed it. Then the interesting thing being that Trump was elected saying, no more regime change, and the track that the U.S. has been on since the election of Hugo Chavez in 1998, really, as evidenced by the coup in 2002 and everything since, is exactly a regime change track.
Yeah, sure. So obviously, Bob Cork is he's no progressive.
Yeah, there was no. My point is, there was no break with the White House when Obama was in there, when he was following the same policy. So it's an interesting situation that's developed, and whether it's personal to Trump or not, it's interesting just that where the Senate, Foreign Relations Committee, and the White House were on the same page for the last 9 years, or even for the last 19 years, suddenly the break develops now.
Yeah, so let's see how the important thing from the point of view of the Venezuelan government is that they have an alternate channel of communication to the U.S. Political elite, and they don't.
Right.
That could be important under different possible
right.
outcomes. So then, sticking with Venezuela and Colombia, the other very important thing that's happened, of course, is that Juan Manuel Santos has announced that Colombia is going to become a global partner of NATO. That is, in terms of Latin American integration and Latin American policy on peace, on nuclear weapons, and a whole series of issues, that does not bode well for Latin American unity.
Yeah.
Because it renders even more difficult now the ability of the South American nations that want to try and put back together again the Union of South American Nations, which is undergoing a crisis as a result of what may or may not be a definitive withdrawal by member countries of the Lima Group in South America, for right. example, Chile, Colombia, Peru,
right.
Argentina, and Brazil too, I think, is part of that group
at the moment. Yeah, I mean, what we're talking about are the U.S. puppet states. You've had the entire project that's been ongoing for the last 20 years in Latin America. Well, for on and off for 200, but accelerated with Chavez taking power in 1999. Integration of the various economic activity across the Central America, South America, Caribbean region, mutual support for each other's sovereignty, emphasis on development of the region and further integration of it, accompanied by socialist governments and or left-leaning governments coming to power in a number of countries across the region, and then which they called the Pink Tide at the time, and then the so-called conservative restoration, which consisted of coups d'etat, a couple of election scams, the removal of Dilma Rousseff in Brazil, however you want to characterize that, and that seems to have reached its ebb point also. With the U.S. more or less seeing the limits of its influence come out in Venezuela in the election, and so maybe what we're seeing happen with Corker, for example, is we've run the limits of that particular policy. Now let's flex it out some.
Yeah, who knows? We'll see how that develops. And it might just be an internal spat in the Republican Party between. Yeah, but anyway, another important thing, and I think you're right about that policy bumping up against its limits. That kind of and I think it's not just in terms of U.S. policy and what the U.S. can get away with, because I think it's also in terms of the limits of neoliberalism. I mean, look at what's happening in Argentina. The Argentinian economy is about to collapse. Why? Because Macri promised growth based on private sector investment, and of course that never materialized. So how has he financed government and his government policies over the last 3 years? By debt. Now, for example, over the next couple of weeks or so, Argentina is going to have to pay back $30 billion in debt. Its debt is now more than it was than it was now, even than when Néstor Kirchner took power. following the crisis in 2001-2002.
Right, at that quite crisis, right. Like the horrible crisis it faced, it's worse now.
Yeah, and so people will say, well, how does that express itself? And it expresses itself in measures like increasing the gas price for ordinary people. Now, remember, Argentina is down in the South Atlantic, and it can get very cold down there. And so people depend on gas not just for cooking, but also for keeping warm. That price increased by 4,000%, right? Mm-mm. Now, you tell me what would happen in the United States if a basic fuel cost increased by 4,000%.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder what the impact was just of that check that Macri delivered to the, you know, to Obama to hand off to the vulture funds that, you know, nobody in the world thought that they had to pay, and Macri gets elected and writes a check right away.
Yeah, so and the what you're seeing is the collapse of neoliberal economics. We talked about this right from the day Macri was elected back in November 2015.
That's right. All those roads lead back. Yep.
It's only a question of time before those neoliberal policies collapse the Argentine economy, and then politically, who knows what will happen? And that's where we are now.
Yep. I mean, it's not even a collapse. It's essentially those policies lead to directly where they led last time. If you have a box full of goodies and your policy is to let people loot the box, where it leads to is an empty box at the end of the period. Right. If you refill the box and then change the policy back to letting people loot it, guess what's going to happen?
Yeah. So, and you're seeing the same thing in Brazil. In Brazil right now, Michel Temer, the president who took over after Dilma Rousseff was ousted in that soft coup back in whenever it was, 2016. He's up against a strike by truck drivers, which is quite ironic because back in 1973, it was a strike by truck drivers that started the overthrow process that led to the assassination of Salvador Allende and the military coup in Chile.
Right.
But there in Brazil, and Temer is up against this nationwide truck driver strike again because he increased energy fuel costs. The combination of his policies attacking pensioners, attacking workers' rights, privatizing very extremely valuable state resources and privatizing, selling off the Petrobras' rights to the enormous pre-sal oil deposits that Brazil has discovered over the last few years to foreign companies. All those moves and the effects are gradually adding up. And you can see that if Lula da Silva is finally allowed to run, he'll walk it, because people in Brazil are sick of the measures taken by the authorities under Michel Temer. Now, will Lula be allowed to run? Currently, he's in prison. There are no signs of legal moves that are likely to get him out of prison anytime soon. But his candidacy has been launched by the Workers' Party, his political party, and it remains to be seen whether the Supreme Electoral Tribunal will allow him to be a candidate.
Right.
And I don't see how they can in terms of their ideology, but in terms of pragmatism, they may say, well, if we want Brazil to be governable, we'd better let him run as a candidate. Who knows? I mean, it's just we'll see over the next couple of weeks. Yeah, if they don't allow him to run, it's not clear at all that the election will lead to a right-wing victory, because there'll be enormous resentment and unrest about the most popular politician in Brazil not being allowed to participate in the election.
Yeah. Yeah, while you have all this activity against the current regime, and by the way, the least popular government official probably on the planet. I mean, Temer's been going downhill since he had a 2% favorability rating last year. And so that's the glue that's being held, you know, holding together this wall against the most popular politician. And by the way, you may remember this, when they had the final vote on Dilma Rousseff back in 2016, they did not vote to bar her from public office for 8 years. Right. She's eligible to run again. So if Lula is barred, Dilma Rousseff may end up running, and you know the way the numbers look at the moment, she may well end up being elected president again.
Yeah, who knows? I don't know enough about Brazil's electoral law, because she can't run for re-election, right?
Right.
But there's been this 2-year interim period,
right,
which may allow her to run. Who knows? Let's see what the Brazilian electoral tribunal decides.
Yeah.
Then another big election, of course, that's happening on July the 1st, is the Mexican election.
Yeah, big one. Yep.
And it seems extremely unlikely that, assuming that he isn't assassinated, that Andrés Manuel López Obrador won't win. And he's got well over 40% support, well ahead of the next candidate, who's down on something like 20-something%. But the thing about that election campaign in Mexico is that, and it over 100, I think the total now is 102 candidates, in what is a very complicated election process, because so many different levels of the Mexican authorities are being elected on July the 1st, from municipal candidates up to the president.
Right.
And the campaign for all those elections started something like seven, maybe even 8 months ago. And during that period, 102 candidates at different levels have been murdered. You know, and that's Mexican politics for you.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
And imagine if there were that guy, even anything approaching that level of violence in Venezuela, you'd never hear the end of it. Yeah. But you don't hear anything at all about it in the corporate media.
Yeah.
So, you know, just another example of the double standards that apply in the corporate and alternative media in North America and Western Europe. Speaking about Western Europe, the European Union has decided that they're going to apply more sanctions against Venezuela because they don't accept the election result, as if the European Union knows anything about democracy.
Right.
All these unelected stooges for the elites in the European Commission and the European Central Bank.
Yeah.
People responsible for the biggest transfer of wealth in history.
Right.
Which
is remarkable, considering, you know, this is the repository of the, you know, the history of transferring wealth from the people of the planet to, you know, the elites in Europe.
The home
of imperialism.
And you still get people, even leftists like, I mean, quite well-known leftists like Ignacio Remanet, and I think even Noam Chomsky from time to time, they'll occasionally talk about Western democracies. What a joke. Anyway, on talking about democracy, we should congratulate Mia Mottley of the Barbados Labour Party, because she became the first woman prime minister in the history of Barbados.
Yep.
I think those elections were the weekend before last. And her Barbados Labour Party won all 30 seats in the parliament there.
Mm.
So congratulations to her. I have no idea what her politics are, but the fact that a strong woman has been elected Prime Minister in Barbados
says something, for sure.
It says a lot.
And we've got to stop there because we're out of time. There's some other stuff I'd like to have covered that we'll have to cover next week. Or maybe later this week, including what's happening in Ecuador, the air accident in Cuba, Piñera taking office and withdrawing reparations for Pinochet victims in Chile, and a lot more. So, Tony, thank you so much for your time. A pleasure to speak with you, as always.
Okay, thanks a million, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.